My name is Doug Webster. I'm the Public Relations Director for the California Maritime Academy. The date is December 7th, 2007. We're in the offices of the President of the San Diego University, Mary Lyons, and Mary, who is past President of Cal Maritime University, is our interview subject today. Mary, I want to start out by asking you, not your entire career, but in the immediate time before you came to Cal Maritime, what were the circumstances that brought you to Cal Maritime?
Well, I had been on the faculty and the dean of the Franciscan School of Theology in Berkeley, part of the Graduate Theological Union. I'd been there 10 years, and I really was looking for a little change. There was no opportunity for upward mobility within the theology school because the next position would have been president, and that has always been held by a Franciscan, you know, friar, at least up to this time, even today. And so I literally saw the advertisement in the Chronicle of Higher Education, clipped it out, left it on my desk for several weeks and kept glancing at it, made a few phone calls to CMA alums whom I knew through my Naval Reserve work and my in the Military Sealift Command, because I'd been in units, MSC units. And I remember one of the alums who was in the reserves and a senior to me said, "Well, Mary," he said, "I think the issue might be your age," because I was, you know, young at that time, and but encouraged me to throw my hat in the ring. So I did that, and very shortly thereafter received a letter, you know, from the search committee thanking me for my application, but declining me an interview because they felt that they had already come to a point where they had finalists. And so I really just put it aside and forgot about it until just before I was ready to leave to teach a course, a summer course at Boston at the Weston School of Theology, a short course. I received a phone call from the then provost of the Academy, Jack Witry, saying that they had reopened the search and asked if I could come and meet with several of the, you know, constituent groups on the campus. And the looking back, the very hilarious part of this, which was, you know, when you think about academic searches, they brought all of the final interviewees together at the same time. And
wow.
So myself and two gentlemen, we all had dinner together with the provost and some other people before we were basically dispersed around the campus for our interviews while I was meeting with a student group. You know, candidate X was meeting with the faculty and candidate Y with another group, and they rotated us around. And so out of that process came the offer for the position.
What was it that attracted you to the school? I mean, the obvious question you have is, why out of a Franciscan Jesuit educational background brings you to a maritime institution, although you had been obviously involved
right,
in that?
Right. Well, I had been in many different academic settings. You know, the Franciscan school was one stop among several. I had, you know, started out many years before that, even teaching elementary school, taught in the public sector as a graduate student and kind of on the circuit. So, you know, I knew by that time that I really was interested in staying in my profession, but I had discovered that I also enjoyed administration, and even though it was on a much smaller scale at the small theology school, it seemed to, you know, give me a lot of life, and I was energized by the challenge. I liked it a lot, and so the opportunity was there in part because I was somewhat familiar with the Academy. I had visited it before. I understood maybe not nearly as thoroughly as I did once I got there, but I had at least somewhat of an understanding of its mission, appreciated that mission, and felt that I would have an opportunity to really learn, and I was not disappointed, I can tell you that, you know. So there were a lot of combination of factors that brought me to the Academy, at least, and most of it was great intellectual curiosity and a desire to grow, mm-hmm. you know, so.
Now, you mentioned you talked to some alumni. You mm-hmm. know. Did you talk to anybody else before you came into the interview to get more background?
not about the academy. I think mostly I talked with alums of the academy who were also naval reservists. Those were the only contacts that I knew. And then the other kind of few homework that I did in preparation, this is now after I knew that I had an interview, was I did a lot of, if you will, kind of research. We didn't have internet, Google in those days, but I read a lot about the academy. I went to the library, saw in the archives, and saw a lot of the press that the academy had attracted, you know, in the year or so before this search was underway. So I had a somewhat of an idea of the, you know, the kind of the reputation and what was happening at the academy, at least from the point of view of the popular press.
Mm-hmm. And between the press articles and your interviews, what was your sense of what they were looking for in an administrator at that point in the school's history?
Well, I had heard, I don't know that this was ever verified, but I had heard that in the initial round of the search, which I mentioned I had been thanked but declined for, you know, in an earlier phase, that the finalists that came before the faculty tended to be essentially cut from the same cloth as previous administrators, and that the faculty had really asked that there be, at least in the pool, some people that had a bit more experience within higher education. And I think that's when I suspect they reached down back into their, you know, applicant pool and pulled out several of us who had, on balance, perhaps a little bit more experience in higher ed than perhaps as flag officers or senior people or people from the industry.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you remember what the enrollment of the school was about the time when you came in?
I think the enrollment was a little under 500, okay. and it hovered in and around that number the whole time I was there.
And how would you describe the school as you came into it in terms of what you saw as its strengths and weaknesses as you took over?
Well, quite honestly, the academy was really under the arc light of several agencies, primarily MARAD and the state of California. When I got to the academy, and it had just come out of, and it wasn't completely out of the spotlight because of some reported incidents on the training ship that suggested a lack of oversight when it would come to sexual harassment. Now, there had been a long investigation and whether or not these accusations, these incidents were overblown or not is neither here nor there. The reality is it really created quite a stir in the public press. I think my predecessor, you know, really had to spend an awful lot of his own time and energy fending off, you know, interviews, having investigation teams from the Federal Maritime Administration or others to come in and examine what was happening. And as a result, there were some changes to shipboard life. For example, I think this is before I arrived on the scene, Neptune, kind of ritual that would happen as people went over the equator was practically eliminated, if not, you know, modified so severely that it didn't resemble anything that had happened before. And I think people's sensitivities as well as their understanding of some of these issues was greatly heightened. And so there were those series of issues that had really brought into the spotlight an institution that not many people had heard about. And then on top of that, the legislative analyst for the state of California had expressed some concerns about the lack of diversity in terms of the makeup of the student population. And when I arrived, we had a mandate to provide a report on progress toward diversity goals. I think we were given 30 days to do this, and the report was to be submitted to the legislature and oversight committees. And so I was very fortunate to have the help of representatives from the California Post-Secondary Education Commission and one of the governmental affairs analysts at the time, Diana Fuentes Michel, who really had, you know, her thumb on the pulse of what was happening in Sacramento, became a very, very great help to me in figuring out what I needed to do. And among the things I needed to do was to get a delay so that I could really get my arms around this and work up a report that would, you know, stand up, you know, with the legislature. So I had a lot to do when I first arrived, and it was just a matter of, in some ways, assuring people that the academy was an extraordinarily healthy, good institution, which of course it was, and on the other hand, building some bridges with constituents that either had not had a good relationship with the academy, had misperceptions about the academy, or had some of those relationships somewhat disrupted, and those needed to be healed and rebuilt.
Who would have been those key constituencies in broad terms?
Well, I think the some of the members of the legislature in particular, we had, and I can't remember the names of them now, but both the Senate and the House representatives, again, not because that they themselves had their, you know, done their own kind of in-depth work, but they had been reading the newspapers, and that, and a lot of times opinions are formed from that source, and they just needed to be educated, and I think above all they needed to be assured that the academy, you know, was in good hands. And as you probably know, at that time, because the academy was a state agency not affiliated with a higher ed system, the board members for the academy, all of whom were gubernatorially appointed boards, at that time Captain Bruce Johnston was the chair. He was marvelous, as were many of the other trustees, in using their relationships with the governor's office and the legislature to try to also, you know, provide some kind of positive, you know, image for the academy. So there were a lot of people who stepped up in that regard.
What were the biggest challenges when you got started? Was that it?
Well, the most immediate challenges were those, because I had heard, you know, anecdotally, that there were even you know, some agitators within the legislature who felt that the academy was a kind of anachronism in the state, and felt that the funding for the academy, which in the scheme of things was a small budget, should be, you know, redirected to other priorities. And so, to some extent, I don't think it would be too much of an exaggeration to say that the academy was very vulnerable at that time. And so that was really a critical thing to, you know, not to address. But there were a lot of challenges. I mean, as you can imagine, there were some personal challenges to give internal as well as external supporters of the academy the assurance that this female that sort of walked in and was now their president wasn't going to, you know, completely, you know, run the academy into the ground or sell it down the river or whatever, you know, aphorism you want to use. I mean, I received letters from some alums, and I remember one alum who, you know, said there was weeping and gnashing of teeth all over, you know, among the alumni that their academy had been, you know, basically given over to a woman. I mean, it was really, there was quite a bit of that sentiment. I'm happy to say that it didn't last long, and in fact, I think some of the people who were the greatest skeptics over time became incredibly wonderful supporters and dear friends as well. But understandably, this was a major change for them, and I think their love of the school inspired them to, you know, feel as if, you know, this was probably one more, you know, kick in the, you know, where after the media had portrayed the academy so poorly. You know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that sort of, you know, sentiment. But aside from that, there really was, I think, a real need to make a strong case for the academy, not just to sort of fend off the its critics, but to really construct a very positive argument for the contribution of the graduates of the California Maritime Academy to the economy of California and beyond that. So, you know, being able to spend a lot of time in Sacramento, you know, appearing before committees, working with CPEC, doing a lot of kind of groundwork. So I spent a lot of time literally walking the halls of the Capitol building, in the governor's office, the legislature, CPEC on one hand, and then also working to answer the concerns about diversity. I think the academy's population, students of color, when I arrived, was hovering around 10%, give or take a percent or two. And that just did not answer the mail for the state at the time. And I'm not sure if this still is operative, but there was an assembly resolution several years before that essentially said that high school graduates in California, men and women of color, who were college eligible, whatever percentage that was, should be reflected in the public institutions in California. So if, for example, there were, you know, say 20% of African American high school graduates were eligible for college, the public institution should have enrolled 20%. And they defined what those groups were. It did not include minority groups or ethnic or racial groups that were already well represented in higher education. So, for example, Asian students, by and large, would not have been included in that factor. Students from the Pacific Islands, Southeast Asia would have been. Students from Spain would not be included, but students, Mexican-American students, Puerto Rican students would be. And so we really had a lot of work to do to, you know, build up the student population in a way that would be consistent with the objectives that the state had set for its own institutions. And what I needed to do, since the budget wasn't going to be expanded, was find advocates and help. And I did that mostly with the wonderful help of industry. So ARCO Marine, for example, Jerry Asplund, who became, you know, the president after me, he in particular and some of his colleagues, among others, there were others, other industry representatives as well, but ARCO Marine in particular helped us create a program that both meant that we were able to not only recruit but retain some incredible students. So I think by the time I left, we had maybe over 30% of our students were students of color.
Yeah. You lived on campus.
I did.
President's House.
I did.
What was it like living on campus?
It was fine. You know, now this is today when I think about it, this is my third presidency, and I lived on the campus at CMA, and then I bought a home in Minnesota, and I'm back on campus again. It was great. It had its pluses and minuses. The commute was short, you know.
It's going home.
yeah. No, it was wonderful. And for me personally, it was very good because I was a single mom, and my son at the time was, about 10 years old. And so it was wonderful that I lived on campus, and it also is an area regionally where my mother was born in Vallejo, and she didn't live very far away. And so she could be home when my son got off the school bus each day. And in that way, personally, it worked very, very well. So I was fine with me and very pleased to have the accommodations.
Now, obviously, you're the first woman president, the only woman president at Cal Maritime. I think there are some who kind of casually look at the history who may have believed that the reason you came to Cal Maritime as the first woman president was in part to deal with an issue of women enrollees at the academy, although women had been at the academy since they came in 73, so it's well after that time. But to what extent was that true, do you know?
You know, to be honest, I never felt that I had been given a charge by the board to address in any, you know, particular way the concerns of our women, you know, students at all. And I'm sure, you know, that would have been the perception given all that the Academy had been, through in the months and year or so preceding my arrival. But certainly there were and there are issues of women in industry when they're, you know, so few in number. I think, you know, I'm not sure of the percentage now, but in those days, I believe fewer than 4% of, licensed, you know, maritime officers worldwide were female. I mean, there's, in any time you have a situation where you have so few, whether it's gender or race or whatever, there are always going to be issues, you know. But I never really felt at all that there had been a particular, you know, mandate from the board, you know, that we brought you here to fix this X, Y, or Z. And quite frankly, there wasn't much to fix. I think, you know, every academic institution, including the one where I am now, is, as I could say, a microcosm of the greater society. And so there will always be issues and problems. But they were not, in my opinion, you know, egregious problems at all for our women, other than the fact that, you know, they're in an industry where they just hadn't been used to having many women around. The Academy, I think, was very enlightened, where sometimes there were real issues were when they would go out to sea, you know, on commercial ships, when they'd go out. You know, I think that's where I know that some of our students had real challenges. And the difficulty, you know, is that the community is so very small that they were very reluctant to speak out about some of the treatment they received because they didn't want to essentially be targeted, you know, and really undermine their own chances of getting hired.
Yeah.
So they really did have some issues. But having said that, I happen to know because I talked to, you know, people who, you know, were about, like, somebody like Jerry Asplund, you know, at Arco Marine at the time, that the industry, at least the U.S., you know, flag vessels, which our students, you know, were in which they rode, they themselves at the same time were, you know, introducing a tremendous number of programs and efforts to help their own crews become more enlightened and understanding, and they did their best. But, you know, when that ship pulls away from the dock and it's way out in the middle of the ocean, things happen sometimes that, you know, all the goodwill and good training that administrators put in place and policies, you know, aren't always adhered to in the same way. So I think, you know, the reality is sometimes different from the ideal.
Yeah. Did you feel at any point that because you were a woman, people were expecting more of you or demanding more of you? Or?
I suppose that that's always... that gender is always on the table, you know. But that had been, at least a woman of my generation, something that I might have been conditioned to anyway because I had already spent a lot of time in the Navy, you know, and at a time when there weren't as many naval officers, you know, whether it was on active duty or as a reservist. And knew that, you know, performance was the measure of all things, but that, you know, in order to, you know, come to the attention of those who would be selecting you for promotion or command, you know, that you really had to demonstrate your leadership ability as well as possible and had to work very, very hard. Similarly, you know, I was in academia, but I was in a theology school, in a Catholic, you know, seminary theology school, where they were very, very few lay people, few women, and you know, as a professor, especially, I think the students, most of whom were male, had expectations. You know, some of them preconditioned to think that, you know, you're not going to be nearly as good as Father so and so. So that's in the culture. I think fortunately, it's not as much an issue as it used to be, but I'm sure it's still an issue. I mean, with our own students, depending on the kind of industry or work in which they live.
You mentioned this a little bit, but maybe you can elaborate on whether you felt that people would have a natural feeling that you didn't understand the school and its traditions. I mean, you were a woman, and you hadn't, probably in their mind, although you would certainly argue that, had as much experience in the maritime environment.
I think those perceptions were correct. I never pretended, nor would I ever want to claim that I really understood, you know, kind of viscerally, the life and the world of intermodal transportation or the U.S. Merchant Marine or, you know, commercial shipping. On the other hand, I don't know that gender has as much to do with that as exposure. And so, I would be willing to say, having some Navy experience, that even a lot of very senior naval officers who had spent their careers perhaps in the U.S. Navy and on board U.S. ships would know a little bit more about the technical parts of, you know, shipping and navigating or engine room procedures, blah blah blah. But they wouldn't necessarily know about the commercial side of the house. And I have to say that I think by then I'd had 7 or 8 years with the Military Sealift Command, which, as you may know, is the Navy's civilian sealift. So a lot of the mariners in MSC are graduates of schools like CMA. So I wasn't a complete tabula rasa. I did know, you know, enough about that, but certainly had a high learning curve, but a willingness and an eagerness to learn. I had really, fortunately, because of the Navy, had a wonderful 2-week course on transportation management, intermodal transportation. I did know something, and learned a great deal more through the experience. I hope, you know, there may have been days when I was one page ahead, but I think I managed in most cases to at least stay that one page ahead, if not even more.
You mentioned some of them. My next question was, how did your career in the Navy Reserve, the Military Sealift Command, how did that prepare you for the presidency? Whereas I know you... And one of your tasks earlier on was educating and providing training programs for underserved audiences through the Navy.
Right.
So that was a natural Cal Maritime.
Right. And that was not through Military Sealift Command. That was as a newly commissioned officer. I was assigned to the Naval Training Center in San Diego, here in San Diego, that had what was called the BOOST program, which I believe still exists only on the East Coast. And it was designed during the years that Zumwalt was CNO to provide college-level preparation for, not exclusively, but primarily sailors and Marines of color to help increase the ranks of officers of those groups. And so I had that experience. But I had taught before I came to the Navy as well, and in very diverse environments.
Yeah. Now I'm going to talk about a big subject, which is CSU. Assimilation of Cal Maritime into that. I was interested in reading one of your past, I think it was the summary of the seminar the living presidents had talking about things, and you had a little anecdote in there on which, before CSU became a reality, one of the legislative analysts called up and said, you know, you're going to have to cut your budget. Mm-hmm. And you said, but we're a 4-year accredited institution, and it didn't really make any difference.
It didn't. That was...
And that's a theme really running through all the things that I've been reading and talking to Jerry or to Joe, is that a constant litany was fending these guys off in Sacramento.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was very interesting because we just were... As I would say, I'd go to budget hearings, for this little agency, and feel like the mosquito next to the 747 when it came to the size of our budget, clearly there was just not a good fit between the academy and its mission and the structures of other state agencies, and it was. The catalyst for the change really did happen around 1990, 91, when the revenues for California were so dismal that Governor Wilson at the time did send out a letter, to all agency heads, requesting and not just requesting, basically, mandating that people prepare trigger reductions of 5, 10, 15% in order to protect his priorities, and the priorities included higher education, thus the call. But the response, of course, was not particularly what I would hope. And so that was one event that, really made me understand that the Academy needed some kind of change. And I had by then also, as I had, done my homework, realized that there was precedent for Maritime academies being part of larger public systems, like SUNY, for example, has, Fort Schuyler. Mass Maritime, the Massachusetts system is a little different, but the closest analogous, the most analogous system would have been the State University of New York system.
Yeah.
And then there was another incident. These just sort of, they were an accumulation of these. We had, when I got to the academy, there was a real need to upgrade the residential life experience for the students. And at that point, faculty members, licensed faculty members, basically still kind of like a, as if they were on a shipboard duty, had a bunk room and were kind of on watch. There was absolutely no attention given to, you know, really to much of what you might call now, you know, kind of common parlance, you know, student of growth and development programming within the residence halls. Certainly a lot of that happened on board ship, but this was a great missed opportunity and a real need, you know, for these young men and women. And so I had to get permission to establish a line item in the budget for at least, you know, one student affairs professional to come and begin to build this program. And I remember, again, I called the Department of Personnel Administration. I had to also work with the budget analyst. And someone with whom I spoke one day said, well, you know, we have a lot of people on the reserve list from the prison system, and I think we could free somebody up to come down there and help you out, you know. Mm-hmm. So I knew then, that was another one of those examples that, no, that's not what we have in mind. I don't need somebody, you know, to stand guard over the students. I need somebody professional to work with them. And so fortunately, again, through some of the relationships that I was able to establish in Sacramento, I was introduced to people within the Cal State system, and the dialogue began. And I was very, very fortunate that the leadership of the academy, and I think this is an important point to be made, never ever did the trustees of the academy, Bruce Johnston and the other members of the board, resist this change, even though in the end it would mean that they would lose their position as trustees of the academy. They were extremely supportive. Naturally, they expected us to do, you know, our due diligence and all the work we did. And the Cal State system itself was also very helpful. Barry Munitz was the chancellor at the time. He and his colleagues, Lee Kirshner, who was then at the time the vice president for academic affairs for the system, for the CSU, and himself had had some experience with military, you know, organizations, having been in the Air Force, and just a smart guy anyway, became a terrific liaison. And so it took a long time to work with all of these relationships, you know, the CSU, my own constituents, and the legislature, the governor's office, to create to get all the approvals and then introduce a bill into the legislature to, you know, move the academy out from under the Civil Service Act to the Higher Ed Act. And the delay, there was a delay of about a year from the time the bill was signed until implementation. I think that's the sequence anyway, but there was a delay in the actual execution of this bill because the unions, there was the contracts under which the employees were needed to expire in order for the new union contracts under the new system to be executed. So, but after that was done, we were brought into the system.
Do you know if there had been much substantive discussion of possible affiliation with CSU before you really began to look at it more seriously?
I had no indication that there'd ever been any talk about that, but there may have been. I don't know, but not to my knowledge.
Yeah. And what were the biggest obstacles to it? As you say, internally it sounds as if people were pretty supportive. Was it mostly legislators that were opposing it, or?
You know, actually, there was no, as far as I know, there wasn't much opposition at all. Once you make a good case and you give good data, people were very, very supportive. I think the only resistance would have been on the part of many of the CSU people, you know, especially campus-based resistance, perhaps. Although I knew some of the presidents, and that helped a lot. But, you know, to take on a campus means to take on an additional, perhaps, liability, although the good thing was that the budget would follow the academy into the CSU, so that it wasn't as if there'd be a huge infusion of cash out of their own, you know, resources to support it. But again, to add, you know, whether or not, I think there was still a question about the wisdom of even having a maritime academy in California. You know, what is this school for? You know, what happened? There is no merchant marine. What do we do? You know, what is this all about? And I think that's where it was, you know, the leadership of Barry Munitz and a few others who essentially became committed to this and managed to be very persuasive and to help convince others that this would have been good, not something that would weaken, but strengthen the system.
And one of the things when I first came in and began learning the institution was Bill's discussion with me and with other people about the whole issue of base budget. That apparently one of the agreements was when Cal Maritime joined the CSU that it was going to come in with whatever budget it had before it had come in, and that was going to be where it started from. Mm-hmm. And the legislature has still never fully caught up with what was in effect a budget shortfall for the institution. If we'd been a CSU institution at that point with what everybody else had, we would have had $2 or $3 or $4 million more in our base budget than we did. And it's been something which, to a certain extent, I think has hampered the institution ever since. One of the things you find all the time, we're a small school, we've grown mightily, but we're really a large collection of one-armed paper hangers all trying frantically without enough support staff to do all the things that larger institutions do. And were you involved in the discussions about that budget transfer?
To some extent, but the reality is, welcome to my world, in the private sector, we don't even have a base budget. So, you're constantly dependent on, the beneficence of others and tuition revenue. And the academy was and has been, I think, always, if you will, under budgeted. But the problem is the budget itself is so vulnerable. If you can't make the case that budget is, really improving the quality of life for Californians, it's the formulae that would be used for an academy wouldn't even begin to meet, its needs. The kind of education that is delivered, whether it be the highly technical education and the parts of the operation of the ship and all that goes along with that is not covered by any MARAD subsidy, and it's extremely expensive.
Yeah.
So, you have the smallest institution in the system where budgets are built on FTE, with probably one of the most expensive academic programs in the system. Put those things together and it's never going to add up to probably adequate funding.
Yeah. You found the alumni pretty supportive of the shift over to CSU?
I think so. I think many alums, I believe, understood that there was a need to do something to stabilize the institution, to give it, to anchor it, if you will, to something bigger than itself in order to assure its continuance. I also think that at least with some of the alums with whom I spoke, that they took a certain pride in the fact that the academy was now going to be regarded as one among many other, well-reputed academic institutions. I think correctly often felt that in terms of the state of California anyway, it had been treated sort of like a stepchild or a second class citizen, and not only alums but many of the faculty I really think felt that they belonged in that community and that now they had a legitimate place within the higher ed community.
During your tenure, the cruise schedule shifted from a springtime to a summertime situation. Can you describe what the cruise, now we have 4 months of cruises, two months to meet our needs. What was the typical time period and what happened on those cruises while you were there?
Well, the change of the cruise schedule was really an interesting moment in my tenure at the Academy because it was driven to some extent by expediency. This came at the time when the Academy, was experiencing a major cut in its budget because of the same problem I described to you. And so I could see that given the size of our budget, there was no way to nibble around the edges and come up with the sufficient, savings to address the trigger reduction. But that by having the cruise in January, the problem was we ended up with keeping our first-year students on the campus and providing all the student support services and academic, you know, life for them while we were replicating everything at sea. By changing the cruise to the end, right after, you know, pushing up commencement, what we ended up doing, of course, was saving a lot of money by only having the food service, for example, and many of the support services just transfer right from shore to the ship. And tweaking some changes with some of the, you know, I think firefighting and a few other requirements to get Z cards for the first year students. What it effectively did is it got the students out to sea earlier, and it got the seniors into the marketplace earlier, and that seemed to have a great appeal. And because the academy was so small, I've never been able to replicate this great advantage. We were literally able to assemble everybody in one room to talk through these issues. I mean, it was a wonderful process, and the debate and dialogue that took place, was very frank. You know, the provost, I think David Wolfe had become provost by then. I'm not sure Jack Wittrie had not retired by then. But everyone participated. I mean, there was a lot of work behind the scenes, but by the time the decision was made, I really felt that people had a stake in the decision. They approved the decision and were able to move on, and we essentially managed to create the savings we needed and without any real harm being done to the academic program. And in fact, I think it improved it to some extent.
Now, talking with Joe, he came in just about the time that then training ship Golden Bear had been acquired. It was the one before this one. And Joe doesn't like to say anything negative, but my sense was he was not enamored of that ship. It had a lot of problems, I think, and part of it was the berthing accommodations for students, both ashore and at sea. And obviously, in that case, what it meant was that he and his successors, over a period of 20 years, were trying to get another ship, and it took a long time to do it. Finally, towards the end of your tenure, it happened.
Right.
When did you start trying to fight that battle?
You know, it's interesting. I had no idea. Talk about not being prepared for the job. You know, there were a few things that were surprises. One was being an agency head. The other one was, I think, that one of the few conversations I had with my predecessor, Admiral Eklund, was about the time I was coming on. He, in a very kind of cryptic way, said to me, "You need a new ship," and handed me a copy of Jane's Fighting Ships, and he showed me a Tagos vessel or something. He said, "This might do." I forget now which type ship, but I think it was a Tagos. And I kind of looked at him like, you know, okay, you know, you just don't go shopping, you know, at Nordstrom's for a new ship. But I knew that was going to be important. And it became more critical. It was really clear that the metal wastage on the training ship itself, I mean, if anybody stomped too hardly on the deck plates, you know, I mean, you could just put your boot right through it in some areas. And the technology was old, you know. Steamship, I know some of the engineering faculty, a couple anyway, loved the steamship for what it would teach the students, but in fact all the technology, you know, was diesel. So, you know, as an educational platform, it wasn't serving the needs of the students as well. And I was very fortunate that once I knew that that's what we needed to do, I just started nosing around, being a little naive and not having a lot of experience isn't a bad thing. And so unabashedly, I guess, I just kept, you know, my ear to the ground and, you know, nosed around, and I spent a lot of time back and forth in Washington, and also, you know, tried to get a sense of what the needs were. Several things happened, you know, almost simultaneously, but knowing that I think the Federal Merchant Marine Academy, Kings Point, had obtained, I think it was the Tagos-type vessel. It was just not big enough. There were just some schools that were getting replacement ships at that time, and I could hear my own faculty and others shake their heads and feel that this just was not a good thing for our academy. But since I was a drilling reservist at the time, one of my colleagues in the reserve unit in which I served was on the faculty at the Naval Postgraduate School, and he had heard that a ship that the Navy had, now that the Cold War had ended, was going to be laid up. And this was the USNS Maury, you know, which was used as a scientific vessel. And one of the wonderful colleagues I had at the Maritime Academy, God rest his soul, Charlie Bonham, who retired Navy captain, who had been with the Military Sealift Command and ran our continuing ed program, he was able to get the information we needed to see whether or not the Maury might be a suitable platform for the Academy. And it certainly had a lot of attributes. It wasn't perfect, you know, but it had a lot of attributes that would mean a ship of its size and without a huge infusion of money to modify it could in fact be, you know, the right ship for the Academy. And so that led me on a journey back and forth to Washington, because this was a ship that basically was operated by the Military Sealift Command, conducting a mission owned by the Navy oceanographer, with MARAD having some oversight of it. And so there were like three or four different agencies within DOD that had a stake and had a piece of this vessel. But I was able to work with Charlie and other people at the Academy, get the support of many different people, and including the California legislature, with great help from my colleagues, you know, the relationships I'd established in Sacramento. We were able to get, you know, support, and the Navy was great with MARAD's support as well to transfer, you know, the vessel. What we needed, about, I think at the time, about $6 million of federal money earmarked for the conversion of the ship. And I had a wonderful bipartisan support from the California legislature, including, you know, people like George Miller and on one end of spectrum, and some of the Republicans on the other, but all had signed a petition, basically, you know, to support not only the transfer of the ship but also the funding. And so, again, going to Washington, testifying, making a case for the funding was, you know, where I spent a lot. I racked up a lot of miles just going back and forth, and you know, by some miracle, the ship was basically, you know, given to the governor, you know, given to the state of California for the Academy. The funding was secured for its conversion, and then there was a little issue of the pier and the fact that, you know, it didn't quite meet the need, even with the sonar dome taken off. So that meant going to the legislature in California for another $6 million or so for a pier, and that took a little persuasion as well. But it did occur, and so the new pier and boathouse were constructed to accommodate the ship. And in the meantime, we did receive word that there was a steam simulator that had been put in, a beautifully Italian-built steam simulator that industry no longer needed, and it was in a warehouse or an old hangar somewhere near LaGuardia in New York. And we received word that if we could get the steam simulator out of there and transport it to the Academy, that we would have a steam simulator. And again, Charlie Bonham and others helped with that project, and so we were able to get the steam simulator to the campus. To satisfy, of course, the engineering faculty who knew that we hadn't yet established a facilities engineering major, but it was clear that many of the graduates were going to work in steam plants, not just at sea.
Yeah.
So that was a real important addition to, you know, to the Academy.
And I actually had a couple things on here, and both the steam stimulator, which you explained, the dock situation. Back up a step to the ship. How long the time period from the time you began to work on the Maury to the point where it was retrofitted in your hands?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I was there 6 years. I would say, you know, the process of just...
5.9.
Yeah. Of starting to look for a ship started practically the day I got there. Not that I was devoted totally to that, but it was, that I knew that was an objective for the Academy. But I would say that it was probably a good 2 years of really intense effort to get the ship, and then of course it was in the yard for, you know, retrofit and modification, so that you know by the time I left in 1996, we had, just before I left, we had the ship, you know, basically turned over to the state of California. Mm-hmm. It was getting ready, but I never got out on the ship on a cruise. You know, by that time I had left, but it was there. I can see it now when I go over the Carquinez Bridge, yeah. And it's a delight. And I've been on the ship, but I think when I left the Academy, I felt that working for the acquisition of the new ship and the transfer of the Academy into the CSU, I felt that was a lot to do in 6 years. And
was John Kiever master at that point? Had he achieved?
He was master for most of that time.
Okay. Was he involved? I assume he must have had some role in working with the Navy to go through what we wanted in the way of specifications for the retrofitting, right?
I'm pretty sure he did. I think Charlie Bonham, was also working. There were a whole team, but yes, the faculty and John and others, there were a lot of people that were involved in that, as well as MARAD, because the naval architects at MARAD, who were heavily involved in the modification plans, because as you probably know, they do provide a lot of the maintenance and repair, support for the ship. And so the naval architects from MARAD were in particular involved in the actual design of the modifications.
The Academy has always had an important role in serving industry, particularly mm-hmm. maritime industry, and as we go on, maritime-related businesses, intermodal, law, environment, so forth. During your tenure, how did you deal with the institution's relationship with that community?
Well, I recognized, very early on that really the key to the Academy's success, but not just in terms of budget, but any ambitions and placement of its graduates, really did rest with the ability of the Academy to demonstrate its relevance to industry. And that's another reason why, increasing the state-of-the-art technology, if the graduates were going to be any use at all to industry, they had to be, state-of-the-art in their training as well as everything else. And so, through the Alumni Association, most of the alums were in the industry, but trying to cultivate that. I don't think we had nearly as sophisticated an alumni outreach. We had some, nor certainly not a development, effort, although the foundation did exist and there was work done as there is today. I mean, it was really kind of in its infancy, but at that time in the history of all of California's, the public higher ed system, there had been very little attention given to fundraising the way it is now, and that was kind of introduced by Barry Munitz a little bit for the CSU. Where I think, we needed and did do some good things, the career placement area was not established particularly, and we hired Captain Shirley Coles, mm-hmm. And she became sort of one-woman show, but did a superb job of arranging for internships and also for interviews for our graduates, and helped with the career placement of those men and women. That was a really big addition, for them, to help them, get placed in jobs. Relationships with the Military Sealift Command continued, and then a lot of the industry support came because of alums like Jerry Asplund, for example. We had a good relationship with Crowley and a lot of industry people, both Mattson, our own, Lynn Korwatch, had herself been a great advocate and continued to be, with the alumni. I don't think the Academy would have been nearly as well positioned vis-a-vis industry if it hadn't been for the alums, for its own graduates who were so well placed.
Yeah.
But we also made calls. Like, I remember, going to see at the time the president of American President Lines and trying to, in what in some ways would look now rather kind of elementary, establish relationships and basically heighten people's awareness about the contributions of the Academy through its graduates. I think where perhaps among the biggest impact, though, was through the continuing education program. And Charlie, I can't remember his last name now, who was the head of continuing ed at the time. We had this, you know, really worked hard to get the bridge simulator, you know, in place and upgraded to do that, you know, bridge team training exercises. When the oil spill technology and requirements became more and more important, you know, being able to host those drills on the campus and to, you know, they kind of introduce in many ways as like the VHS tracking systems. And Manny Ashmeyer was another alum from Southern California who was very supportive. There were just a lot of ways in which, you know, you just try to keep the relationships nourished and open, and those wonderful people really, I think, had such a devotion to the academy that they made it possible for our graduates to have good mentors and good placement, and for the continuing ed program to be able to provide, whether it was radar training or other kinds of continuing ed training to keep people's licenses current. It really, it was a very nice symbiotic kind of series of relationships.
Yeah. What's your proudest accomplishment during your tenure at CMA?
Well, I mentioned, I think, the ship, you know, working to bring the ship to CSU, I mean, to the Academy, and the CSU change. I mean, I think those two things were initiatives that I would never claim that I did anything by myself, that's for sure. But those were two major initiatives that happened, if you will, on my watch, you know. And leaving the Academy, I think, stronger than when I found it, and more secure in terms of its own institutional placement and within the, again, on the landscape, not only higher ed, but also, you know, for industry. I think that was really important to me.
And what would you wish you could have accomplished that you didn't have time to?
Oh, my goodness. I would have loved to have seen the Academy grow more in terms of the student body, you know, and it being able to introduce even more of the campus life and features that so many of their counterparts in other campuses would have had. I think the resources were still so limited that our students just didn't have the benefit of a lot of the sort of, as I said, whether it's in student services, you know, residential life, that kind of thing.
What was the enrollment when you left?
It was about 500, you know, kind of would go up and down. I think it took a while once we were in the CSU for that kind of wave to sort of, you know, gain some momentum with regard to the you know, public awareness of the Academy and that kind of higher ed experience as an option for youngsters. And I'm sure it still suffers from a little bit of, you know, lack of visibility because of the programs, but it's very well respected. And I think the other good thing that happened for the Academy that didn't happen while I was there, and I'm not sure it was time, but the diversification of the curriculum, the fact that now students do have some options they wouldn't have had before, namely, you know, when I was there, it was still the requirement that students had to receive their Coast Guard licenses in order to get their baccalaureate degree and vice versa. And now that there's more diversity in terms of the curriculum and the opportunities, I think that's probably a very, very good thing.
Yeah. What are the most important things you learned during your tenure at CMA?
I learned so much. I think I personally grew a lot as an administrator. I mean, I learned that there are so many talented people who are so generous and willing to help that, you know, we couldn't have done anything there if it hadn't been for people's generosity and willingness to join in accomplishing the mission, whatever it happened to be at the time, but the mission of the Academy. And I learned that, personally, I learned that I could, you know, really do things when I, you know, would have maybe not had the confidence. You know, I mean, if anybody had told me before I got to the academy that somehow I would have been involved in, you know, ship acquisition or, you know, moving, you know, an institution within a state agency out of, you know, from, I would have laughed. I would have thought, that's impossible. I don't know anything about that kind of stuff, you know, which I didn't. But I had tremendous colleagues and great support, and I really, you know, loved the work and the people and the students. I learned so much about the capacities of young people. You know, I wish that every college or university president or administrator or faculty member could witness what I see when you get on a ship and you see these very young people standing watch on the bridge or in the engine room, you know, and a magnificent vessel like the training ship being, you know, operated by, navigated by very professional, serious, competent students with their incredible faculty members, you know, the officers and faculty who mentor them and who stand back and trust them enough to make wise, good decisions and to act prudently. I mean, that is something that very few people get to witness, and it's really very gratifying.
What were some of your most enjoyable moments?
Well, as I just mentioned, you know, seeing the students, especially performing at sea, was incredible. There were a lot of enjoyable moments, I have to say. I loved the academy is a very small kind of familial place, and because of that, you know, it was much easier to sort of have nice, social times. You know, one of the most kind of amusing moments for me was when I came to the academy brand new. And there was a wonderful lady working in the bakery, working in food service, who knew my mother, knew the family, and knew that I had many years ago, when I was right out of high school, had been in the convent, and I guess, you know, thought of me as a rather pious, you know, Catholic girl, and she wanted to bake a very special cake for me for my kind of inaugural moment and put a statue of the Blessed Mother on the cake. And I thought, I kind of discouraged that. I thought, no, as nice as that was, I think that was not the place for that, you know. But that warmed my heart so much, you know. It was just one of those precious, you know, kind of moments. And, I think there are other fun things, like we used to have the Sea Scouts once in a while come and camp along the seawall, you know, and they'd camp and then they'd have little food fights with the cherry tomatoes, and the next spring, whatever, there'd be all these volunteer tomato vines growing out from the rocks.
We saw those this year.
Yeah,
nobody
exactly.
knew they were there.
Yeah, that's from the Sea Scout camping. You know, okay. They just, you know, these little seeds.
I didn't
that
realize
get
that mentioned. Heritage went back then.
That's so they're just fun things like that.
What haven't I asked that I should have asked you?
Oh my goodness. Good question. I think the oral histories. What I don't know is I don't know how much of the records from the tenure of any one of us have been archived. You know, I mean, I don't think I was as savvy as I am now. You know, and we really. It was a pre-internet, you know, email was just getting introduced about the time I was leaving. And so there should be a very good, I hope, a good record of things.
My understanding is that there's a, you know, a pretty good collection of your papers. You
okay.
know, each outgoing president
okay.
has turned things over.
That's good.
And they have been at least been cataloged. How well
okay.
they've been documented in detail, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, that's good. The question you asked me, which I reflected on, was what are some of the big differences between the academy before and after becoming part of the system, you know. And I do think that it was the best decision. Although I have to say that I really missed my board. I missed very much, and it's something that I think Joe Rizza did so well, and I hope I did well as well. And that was a hard thing to do, is to basically give over some of the responsibility that we had as individuals for being our own advocates for the academy. So the governmental affairs group for the Cal State system more or less, you know, is the advocate for all the system. And it's not as easy for individual presidents to go and make their case to individual legislators as it was during, you know, most of my time there. And I always felt that that was one of the more difficult things, because the academy, unlike most of the other CSU campuses, serves not only California, it serves the whole Western United States. And so all legislators, you know, from, you know, especially in California, from the northern border to the southern border, all potentially benefit from the graduates and from the work that it does. And from my, I'm not sure, I think some of the faculty, probably more now, are very much involved in scholarship and research and contributions that they make through their own work. And so for me, giving up that, to some extent, that was a trade, that was, there were always trade-offs, but that was one of the trade, you know, kind of a little bit of a trade-off, not having quite the same ability to do that, although far, far more resources, and many of the CSU trustees are extremely supportive of the academy. But, you know, there are trade-offs and everything, but I think on balance it was certainly, as I look now and get the alum magazine and see that the enrollments have grown, what is the enrollment
now?
Over
800 now.
It's amazing. It's wonderful. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
Had a 275 incoming freshman class.
Yeah.
We're kind of plateauing at that point right now because, well, we've got approval to build a new dorm, but that's going to be another 2 years before that's ready, and
yeah,
even then it won't be enough.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a constant struggle to keep ahead. And as Bill said, you know, the problem is there's no reward in the CSU system for being small and good. You
that's
just got to
right.
keep growing.
Yeah,
that's
that
sort
is
of a
true.
Constant
yeah, yeah.
Let me turn this off here.